Hello, Internet. This is Chase Wassenaar, and welcome to Steam Cleaners, presented by the Rough Drafts Podcast Network. Every 2 weeks, my lovely co-host and I talk about video games that we haven't talked about on this show before, and we get to share our thoughts with each other and you lovely listeners at home. And of course, when I say we, I am referring to my favorite podcast co-host that I've had for almost a decade now, Walter Seades-Fetchuk. Walter, how you doing, buddy?
Holy shit. Well, first of all, why are you asking me that question? You saw me yesterday. And two, has it really been a fucking decade?
I mean, it has to be, right? Because we were absolutely like doing guests, like at the very least, like less than legends. Like I was in college, which was like 2014. So yeah.
Oh, it my is, Lord. It is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. That sounds about right. Wow. It's been a decade.
Crazy. Yeah. Time makes fools of us all. But yeah, I mean, by the time that y'all are listening to this, Walter and I have been hanging out IRL for the first time in half a decade. So I see that as an absolute win. Walter, what was your favorite part of the trip you technically have not been on yet?
You know, Chase, I am going to have to say, because the Oscars are in town, it was when Kate Blanchett found out where I was staying and came and beat the ever-loving shit out of me for besmirching her good name in Tar, and then for not giving a shit that she's in the Borderlands movie. So, you know, Hollywood, man, you run, you know, Los Angeles, you run into stars all over the place. No, you know what? I really don't know, because I know a couple of the things we have planned. We're planning on going to the LCS Friday right when I land, because that was the only day we could get tickets for. And then I am going to drag you to an LA Clippers game because I wanted to go to something at the Staples Center. No, I will not call it Crypto.com Arena. It's the Staples Center.
Nobody here does. That's the right call.
Perfect. But yeah, I think I said to you like last year, like, oh yeah, I really want to come out and see you in LA. And then I didn't last year. And then this year I was like, I'm going to make it one of my number one priorities this year to come out to LA to see you. So I think my favorite thing will be seeing you and seeing all the other like esports friends that I had, you know, back in the day, and getting to see everybody live and just hanging out and having a good time. So it'll be nice to catch up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a lot of people. I'm very excited for us to all get to hang out and play some games over at Guildhall, and just the shenanigans that are possible when you're seeing someone in human form rather than just as wavelengths on a podcast. So very excited for that. But I hear that you're very excited for something that will be coming up before then. I believe there is an AEW pay-per-view coming down the pipeline. Is that right?
You are absolutely correct. As we are recording it, it is technically, if you're on the East Coast, it is Thursday, February 29th. If you're on the West Coast, it's Wednesday, February 28th, because it is very late in the evening / early in the morning. But yes, on Sunday, March 3rd, we have the Revolution pay-per-view headlined by the icon, the legend, Sting's final match, coming from the Greensboro Coliseum in Greensboro, North Carolina, an iconic venue in the wrestling world, particularly in kind of the Mid-South, you know, NWA, WCW territories back in the day that Sting spent a lot of time in, particularly WCW. He was kind of their version of The Undertaker, the legend that was there forever. But even beyond that, it's a really fucking good pay-per-view card. You know, I think with WWE having, you know, a really good Royal Rumble, you know, Cody winning again, him going to challenge Roman Reigns, but then The Rock coming back and The Rock was going to challenge Roman Reigns instead because CM Punk got injured and CM Punk was supposed to fight Seth Rollins. So they're going to put Cody versus Seth. And then everybody fucking hated those ideas because why is Cody giving up his opportunity to The Rock of all people? And then The Rock backstage being like, yeah, you know what? I don't want to be a babyface anyways. Let's full on fucking heal this thing. So now we have Cody versus Roman again, but now like The Rock's involved and The Rock is pulling off his best Mr. McMahon impersonation, but not McMahon the sex pest, but McMahon the, like, I'm a corporate character, la la la. You know, and they just had this pay-per-view in Perth that was headlined by Rhea Ripley because she's from Australia. Like, a lot of good stuff going on in the Fed. Well, AEW is like, yeah, we'll top that with Sting's retirement match. And unlike Ric Flair, he's actually going to fucking retire. But lower down the card, we have what was originally going to be a Meat House Madness match that, due to some injuries, is now being changed to an All-Star Scramble match. So there's going to be a bunch of guys in a match for a future shot at the AEW World Championship, including Chris Jericho, Wardlow, Powerhouse Hobbs, Lance Archer, Hook, Brian Cage, and two other wrestlers to be announced. We're going to have a tag team match between FTR. Chase, you may better know them as The Revival from WWE. Oh, they've been in AEW for a while, but I think that's how you would remember them. They're going to be wrestling against Blackpool Combat Club, which is Jon Moxley and Claudio Castagnoli. Just a tag match. They've been wrestling each other for a few weeks here on the weekly shows. They hate each other's guts. We have Christian Cage with the Patriarchy. That's Killswitch, Mother Wayne, and the Prodigy, Nick Wayne. They're his kind of, you know, faction against Buffalo's own Daniel Garcia in what may have been finally the greatest comeback to a Christian Cage promo. Christian Cage asking Daniel Garcia if his mother still lived at 2 Baker Court in Buffalo, which, if you Google that address, is a cemetery. Him saying, your father's dead, which is one of his, like, great catch lines in this fucking heel run that he's had, to which Daniel Garcia immediately responded, yeah, and in 2 weeks you'll get to meet him. Just, oh, Christian Cage is one of the best heels in wrestling, and babyface Daniel Garcia is exactly what the world needs. We also have the official full-time debut of Will Ospreay in AEW. He has now left New Japan Pro Wrestling and will be a full-time every week competitor here in AEW. He is going to be wrestling Konosuke Takeshita, who is, you know, part of the Don Callis family, which they turned on Kenny Omega, and, you know, uber heel, foreign heel thing that's been going on, but they're both part of the same faction. So how are they going to coexist? It's pretty clear they're going to turn Will Ospreay babyface, get him away from Don Callis, and let him go do fun flippy shit for a new audience. We also have Eddie Kingston as the Continental Crown Champion against Bryan Danielson. And the big thing, Danielson doesn't respect the King of the Bums, Eddie Kingston. But if Danielson loses, he's going to have to shake Eddie Kingston's hand. I'm dead serious.
No, I believe you.
Doesn't respect Eddie Kingston. So if he loses, he has to shake Eddie's hand. Obviously, if he wins, he will become the Continental Crown Champion. Then we have what may be of interest to you, Chase. Timeless Toni Storm. I know I've sent you some clips of her gimmick of the 1920s starlet. She is the AEW Women's Champion. She will be wrestling against Deonna Purrazzo. You might not know a lot about Deonna. She's mainly been with TNA, had a little brief stint in NXT. She is the Virtuosa. Very good women's wrestler. Another one of those kind of free agents that AEW has acquired here in the last 6 months. Get a nice little feud that's been going on with them. Hopefully that is something that lasts a bit longer than just this pay-per-view. We have a trios match for the AEW World Championship between Samoa Joe, Hangman Adam Page, and Swerve Strickland. The big thing being here, Samoa Joe is the champion after beating MJF at the last pay-per-view out in New York City. Hangman Adam Page, Swerve Strickland, both earning shots at Samoa Joe's championship, but they've been in a feud all of their own, and Hangman Adam Page has sworn that he will never allow Swerve Strickland to be a champion in AEW. Hangman is the babyface in this feud, by the way. There's also a singles match between Orange Cassidy and Roderick Strong. And then there is the main event, which is Sting, the Icon's final match. Him and Darby Allin, the AEW World Tag Team Champions, against the Young Bucks, the executive vice presidents themselves, Matthew and Nicholas Jackson. That is a tornado tag team match, which basically means it's not really a tag match. Everybody's in the ring at the same time. It's a little bit, you know, kind of street fighty, and it'll be a lot of fucking fun. And it brings up a very interesting question of who is going to win that match, because historically a wrestler goes out on their back, right? When a wrestler mm-hmm. retires, they're supposed to lose. Mm-hmm. But you know, the Young Bucks, Tony Khan, a lot of guys that are here in this promotion are their marks, right? They love Sting. They grew up with Sting. Mm-hmm. And I think they will be pushing for Sting to go out standing tall, you know, get his flowers, get his, you know, his curtain call, his, you know, final wave goodbye. Something tells me though, Sting's been backstage being like, nah, that's not the way to do it, guys. I go out on my back. So it'll be very fun to see who wins that match.
At the very least, it feels like then you'd have to vacate the title, because Darby is not, like, he can't do it on his own if this is Sting's last match.
Well, I mean,
I feel like once you make it a title match, it's like, why would you take it off the Young Bucks just to vacate it when, yeah, wrestling tradition says go out on your back?
Well,
it feels like that one's...
So the belt is actually on Sting and Darby.
Oh,
they're the champions. They beat Ricky Starks and Big Bill, who you will know as Big Cass from Enzo Amore and Cass. Yep, that's Big Cass.
Yeah,
Ricky Starks and Big Cass. I'm sorry, Big Bill. They were the champions, and then they lost it to Sting and Darby Allin. You know, there's a couple of different things at play here. This isn't the first time that you might have somebody like. There's been times where somebody's gotten injured and then the tag champion has to find a new partner, right? Like, there's exceptions to the rule. The other thing to know is that Darby Allin is gearing up to climb Mount Everest. He is climbing Mount Everest in April. So if you needed to write him off television, you could just have the Young Bucks like murder Sting and Darby Allin on pay-per-view, write Darby Allin off for a while, let the Young Bucks, Matthew and Nicholas Jackson, don't call them Matt and Nick or else they'll fine you. Be the champions, write those guys off. But then, yeah, there is this entire thing of like, okay, well, if you're going to maintain kayfabe and the Young Bucks kill Sting, how is he going to stand up and get his applause, right? Which everyone wants to give him. It is his retirement match. So I could see it going either way. I could see Sting and Darby winning it. And then on Wednesday, the Young Bucks challenging Darby to a rematch and be like, oh, well, if you can't find a partner, you have to fight us one on two. And like Darby Allin would totally do that because that's his character and you know, so on and so forth. So it will be interesting to see which way they go. But my guess is by next week, the Young Bucks will be the champions one way or another.
Yeah. I mean, is there any chance Darby Allin has a new partner in the works? Has anything been set up for I've lost Sting, but now I have this new guy who I think,
you know,
who could save him here?
Not really. They have done a little thing where he has had Adam Copeland, better known as Edge in the Fed. Mm-hmm. He's kind of hung around him a little bit, but he's been taken out by Christian Cage. So he's been, you know, probably going to be gone for a little while. The Prodigy, Nick Wayne, is actually the son of Buddy Wayne, who was Darby Allin's mentor. And Darby brought Nick Wayne into the company because he is Nick Wayne's coach. And then Christian Cage and Darby had a feud over it. And Christian Cage won the rights to Nick Wayne by Nick Wayne turning on Darby Allin and turning heel. But beyond that, Darby really doesn't have a lot of friends in AEW. He is very much kind of a lone wolf. Even, you know, before Sting came in, he was very much, I'm by myself. I'm a lone wolf. I am a rebel. I am an outcast, so to speak. And then Sting came in, they paired them together. And that's really what Sting was back in WCW. He really did not have a lot of direct allies. He usually kind of relied on himself and won matches himself. And if he lost, he lost, but he was going to do it his way, his style. There's been quite a joke going on because they have announced, there was a screenshot of Bill Skarsgård's garb for the remake of The Crow. Right, they're remaking The Crow, and the joke has been, well, Sting took his gimmick from the old Crow movie, and now Bill Skarsgård is taking his gimmick from Darby Allin for the new Crow movie. So everything's a circle; it's all fucking poetry, if you ask George Lucas. So,
it rhymes.
Hey, it rhymes. I'll be curious to see what they do, but it's gonna be one hell of a fucking paper.
I love that's where you draw the line.
Oh, goodness. But yeah, I'm very excited for it. It'll be a very good pay-per-view. And I'll be honest, I don't think there's been a single AEW pay-per-view that is really missed, in my opinion. And I've watched all of them.
It certainly sounds like a great time. And I do love getting into these cards more, especially as we've been doing our bi-monthly streams going into our own wrestling league, the Rough Drafts Competes Journey of Wrestling competition that is on twitch.tv/RedShirtKing. And y'all should definitely check out sometime because it's fun. But plug aside, this is not a wrestling podcast, Walter. As we have said numerous times, it is a gaming podcast, and thus we have to pivot into gaming. So I ask you, what have you been playing recently?
So SmackDown versus Raw 2003 was on the PlayStation 2. No.
Hell yeah.
No, that's not what I played. You know, Chase, I was honest to you in the pre-call. I didn't really play a whole lot the last couple of weeks. I don't know why, right? I played a lot of Madden. I played some League. I just kind of was like, busy, right? A lot of stuff going on. It was Valentine's Day. It was my partner's birthday. Just a lot of stuff, right? A lot of stuff going on. And I've had this game that I've kind of been playing in the background that I've just been like, I want to put more time into it. It's a roguelike, right? It needs more time. I haven't beaten it even once yet. And it got down to Monday, and I was like, okay, I gotta pick a game for the podcast. And I thought about like, okay, well, let me just go pick something I played way back when. I'll throw a couple hours into it, just kind of refresh it. I'll talk about that. And then I decided not to do that because I'm lazy, and instead played the game I am going to talk about, and I have kind of kept on the back burner because, again, I'm lazy. I don't know when I'll actually get to beating it. And I do feel like I have a good enough handle on it. I have played, you know, over 11 hours of it. I think I have a pretty good enough handle on it that I can talk about it. While I might not know all of the plot, I can talk about the game in and of itself. And that is Gearbox's Have a Nice Death.
Which I've heard good things about, theoretically. I remember when it came out, it got some positive reviews. It was difficult, was the thing that I heard. But anytime you got to play as Death and use a scythe to tear through some fools, that sounds like a good time.
Yeah, listen, I'm gonna jump the shark here. I'm gonna stay out right out in front. Fucking love this game. It's a great fucking game. My inability to beat it has nothing to do with not liking it or it being too difficult. It's a hard game. I'm not going to pull a punch here. It's a hard game. But, you know, Chase, the best thing about games, there are difficulty settings, right? Mm-hmm. And let me like kind of rewind and give you just a brief synopsis of what's going on. Yeah. You are playing Death, the Grim Reaper, and you are the CEO of Death Incorporated. And you have to go out into the building and defeat your subordinates, your workers, your managers that have become out of control. And it's a roguelike. And as you go through, you become stronger. You unlock abilities. You unlock weapons. You unlock spells. You unlock all these things. And you get to do all the fucking shit that a roguelike does, right? The thing is, Chase, at the beginning of this game, there is a trigger warning. There is a content warning that talks about disturbing themes like suicide, addiction, harassment, burnout, overworked, all of these things. Because like much like the game that we talked about, it's been a long time since we talked about it, Going Under. That was also kind of a fighter, bruiser, roguelike game. This deals with criticisms of corporate work environments. Does that sound like maybe a piece of media we've recently consumed and talked about on the podcast?
I can only imagine that people who are subscribed to the full Rough Drafts feed or at least keep in with Final Cut might find some similarities between this and the last film that we watched. Yeah, good episode last Monday. Go check it out. It's interesting that you compared it Going Under. So how, like, how fully corporate are we talking here?
I mean, you're the CEO of Death, like Death Incorporated, right? Like, you have paperwork, right, just piled up all over your desk, and you walk down and you go down the elevator into the lobby, and like there's a queue of fucking souls coming in, and there's a counter above it that's like, oh, you know, 2,197,678, and it like ticks up and ticks up. There's a moment in the game where it reaches 9999, all nines, and it's like, oh, congratulations, boss, we broke the counter. And you're like, what? Yeah, we took in so many souls, we broke the counter. And the funny thing is, getting back to the difficulty settings, your difficulty settings are based on what level of breakdown you're having, because a lot of what this game deals with is overwork, right? The story is essentially you are Death and you are overworked. You are bored with your job, you are overworked, and you just want to go on vacation. But you can't go on vacation if nobody is doing their job correctly, if nobody is going to hold down the fort while you are gone. And that's what's happening, right? You go through the different levels, which are different departments of Death, that deal with different aspects of Death, right? There's the first couple of levels, that the first choice you get to, you have a level that deals with pollution, where all the mobs and all the enemies are like sludge piles, right? And the big boss is this giant thing of sludge. Or you deal with, you own apparently a fast food franchise, and it's gluttony, and it's like you're fighting against Mr. Shake from Aqua Teen and Hunger Force, and you're fighting against like a little burger thing, and you're fighting against the big boss is literally just like Big Boy, right? Like fucking Big Boy Burger. That's what you're fighting against at the end. That's the boss of that level. You have other levels that deal with like physical ailments and addiction. The last level that you get to, you deal with either natural disasters or war, and you know, all the hallmark progressions of what you get through from what you would expect from these sort of side scrolling beat 'em up roguelikes, right? You have variety of enemies, you have different different themes around all the levels, all these things. But at the end of the day, you're Death. You're trying to get all your affairs in order so you can go on vacation.
See, it's very funny to see a game idea used in a completely different genre from the last time that I encountered it. Because a game that I haven't talked about on the podcast, because I played it before we had a gaming podcast, was Death and Taxes. And Death and Taxes, you get hired to be a Grim Reaper of sorts. You're given like files that you need to process and decide who lives and who dies every day, while trying to follow instructions that you are given, quotas that you need to hit on like who you're saving and who you're not. And it's all bureaucracy focused, right? You are part of, I don't think it's called Death Incorporated. I forget exactly what it's called, but like you have coworkers, right? There's a bar everyone goes to after work. And you are approaching it from this kind of, kind of like Papers, Please, I suppose, in just trying to evaluate these files as best you can and make a decision that keeps everything in order. I imagine, given the genre that I know this game to be, that this is not about the bureaucracy therein, so much as figuring out what sorrow, like how to kind of approach each of these problems and earn that rest through an entirely different medium. So how did you find the gameplay as you tried to finally get yourself that vacation?
I mean, the gameplay is kind of what you expect from a side-scrolling platform, kind of beat 'em up, right? It has some shades of Hades. It has some shades of Call to the Lamb. It has some shades of Guacamelee, right? You have, you know, weapons that you start with. You unlock these different couple of abilities. You get to utilize those abilities. As you build up fury, you again can, you know, use a super version of one of those abilities. As you're going through the run, you're getting power-ups, you're getting buffs, you're getting a currency to spend at a shop or an upgrade location in between the level and the boss fight. You know, all these different progressions. As you, you know, fail more and more and more, you unlock more and more types of abilities, right? As you level up, you can permanently unlock, you know, abilities that infuse your attacks with lightning, with fire, with lifesteal, with slow, with, you know, movement slow, with time slow, like all of these different things. It is very much the roguelite play loop, right? That I've really grown to enjoy. I really, really enjoy it. And I think it's something that I can specifically point to Hades as saying, like, hey, that was what convinced me that these types of games are really, really fun to play. And that there is a struggle to them of, you know, finishing something, of actually getting the entire story versus, you know, something like an Elden Ring. Right. Elden Ring, to me, it's the same thing. It's this kind of grind of you're failing constantly, constantly, constantly until you finally succeed. But these roguelikes kind of level the playing field because you get a little bit more every time you fail, right? Whether it's you get another ability unlocked, you get another type of weapon unlocked, you get a little bit more currency to use outside to make it easier when you go into it, or to just learn a little bit more of the story. Again, it's not an easy game. And even though you do have kind of a difficulty selector that can make it easier, I've never beaten the game, right? I haven't gotten the actual full win. I have done one playthrough where I got to the end, quotation marks, but then it turned out it wasn't the end, right? You know, Hades, it's, oh, you get to the real world where then you discover Persephone, right? That's the first time you beat it. Well, imagine if instead you got to Cerberus, and then after you got past Cerberus, then there was no Hades fight. And then instead you just failed, right? Like, instead you were walking across the bridge to get to what will eventually be the Hades fight, but the bridge just collapses underneath you and you die, right? I was kind of like taken aback. I was like, wait, why isn't it said I've beaten the game once? I thought I beat the game. Well, no, that's not the final boss. And it is part of this storytelling loop of Death is just trying to go take a vacation, but he can't because the company would fall apart without him because, like it or not, he is the personification of Death. He is literally the Grim Reaper. How is Death supposed to happen without him? Which is just entirely fascinating. And I really wish I had time to put five, 6 hours a day into this where I could actually beat it a couple of times to see what the end result of that story is.
Yeah, I think that was gonna be my next question, because I know you've played it on and off for a while now. I see some achievements going through your Steam history going back to November. So, cause all of this sounds great. This all sounds like, a well executed, roguelike, a genre that I know that you enjoy. So what halted your momentum the several times that you've tried to pick it back up again? Has it been difficulty? Has it been the story not keeping you engaged? Because obviously you've played other games since then, so you have had time to play some games, but it doesn't seem like you've consistently gone back to this one.
So the problem has been I've been trying to play other games for the podcast so that I could go back and play this, but the I guess the problem is, and I it's not a criticism of the game, it's a criticism of me, is like, sometimes I get home from work and it's like, you know what sounds great? I'm just going to play two games of Madden and then I'm going to go to bed, right? Or, yeah. Hey, a friend of the podcast, Amanda, messages me and says, hey, do you want to play some League? Absolutely, I'll play some League. Or I've got to record podcast tonight. Oh, I got to do the Journey of Wrestling thing tonight. Oh, I have to play in our Cyberpunk game tonight. Oh, I haven't spent time with my partner in 3 days because of all the other things I'm doing. I'm going to spend time with them. It is not anything to do with the game. it is everything to do with my life, which I can't think of a better comparison to the fucking game, because all I want to do is sit and play the game for a few hours, just like Death wants to go on vacation for a few hours, but everything else gets in the way.
Yeah. I feel the same way about Neon White, a game that I absolutely love and I can't wait to talk about when I get to it. Because while I love the game, I am not good at shooters, especially shooters that involve a lot of like platforming elements to them. So I'm loving it, but I'm bad at it. And it can take me a while to beat a single level at the time that I'm comfortable with, because I'm trying to beat every level with at least a gold score, because that's how you climb up the ranks and get the true ending, and there's no fucking way I'm missing out on something like, with the narrative and stuff that I enjoy. But some days I just don't want to get my ass kicked by a game, right? Like, I want to play something that's more naturally in my wheelhouse. I want to play something that I can play with something on the other monitor, right? And as a result, a game that I love and I can't wait to talk about has just fallen to the wayside. And I think that's a really salient point you made, that sometimes it's not the game's fault. I am curious if there's anything as you've been playing it that you would change, like if there was a sequel, right? Have a Nice Death to Electric Boogaloo. Is there anything that you think can be improved upon, or is this the best version of this game and you just can't wait till you find enough time to go back to it?
I think it's the best version of this game. Wow. And that's not even me being like, oh, what's the easy answer to this question? Like, of course it's perfection, like blah blah blah. Like, it's more of I can't immediately think of anything that I would change, right? Okay, maybe. So one of the things they say is there's procedural generation of the levels, which I'm not going to say is a lie, because there is procedural generation of the levels. But you and I had this conversation not too long ago about AI and building games in AI and utilizing AI in something like Starfield, right? To help build out these thousands of planets that they have. And the reality is that at some point it is always going to feel very samey and very repetitive, because there are only so many iterations of something you could generate. And like, maybe with AI, instead of there being 30 different iterations of how to do something, you could make 1,000, but eventually you would go through all of them enough that you would catch the pattern. And I will say, much like Hades, where the levels are different, right, in terms of like the ordering you go through them, the levels might be different, and you do have some pathing options in terms of which sorrow do you want to go deal with. Do you want to deal with disease, or do you want to deal with addictions? The reality is you eventually start to see that the levels you are going through are being repeated. And not from sorrow level to sorrow level, right? Disease and addiction, those maps are always going to look different, right? Those levels are always going to look different. But every time you go to disease, eventually you're going to start to see the pattern of, you know, how it's designed. And oh, if I go this way, I know there's going to be a platform here. I know there's going to be a platform here. I know there's going to be a platform here. The enemies may be in different spots, and it may be a different enemy that is there, but the overall structure of the level is eventually going to get, and it's a pejorative sounding term, but repetitive. Maybe that's the one thing that I would change, is add some more iterations so it does feel a little less repetitive. But like, no, this is a really, really fucking good game. It's hard. Right? It is hard. And the only time I've beaten it is I turned it down to like the lowest level, where it like has reduced damage from the enemies. You have increased damage. You start with 3 of the healing orbs. Like, it gives you help to get you through it, but the game doesn't like punish you for it. Like, it still counts, right? All the achievements still unlock. And then you have the progressive level of breakdowns that you're allowed to, that you want to go through. If you want to go through an imminent breakdown, which is like the third level difficulty, right? So it's probably hard normal's just like a breakdown, and then not a breakdown is the easy one. Like, you can go through all those, and like, there will be a reward for if you beat it on, you know, the highest breakdown level. Like, it does exist. But like, it's a really fucking good game. The combat feels pretty fluid. Could you like fine tune some of the abilities or some of the weapons to make them feel stronger? Because like, there's one where you just can like, it has like a couple of orbs that go around you, almost like old Aurelion Soul. And then if you use the full frenzied version of it, it's like way more in a much larger radius. That ability is fucking busted. That ability is so fucking good. And the two times I've gotten through almost, the one time I thought I quote unquote beat it, and my most recent run that I had where I almost beat it, I had that ability and I was like, oh, this is fucking busted. Because when those orbs deal damage, they increase your frenzy bar. So you can just like keep recycling that as long as you're dealing enough auto attack damage during its, you know, frenzy iteration to then just have another frenzy right after it. It's pretty fucking busted. It's really strong. But yeah, this game is fucking awesome. I highly, highly recommend it. It's absolutely worth the $25 to buy it outright. If you can get it on sale, get it on sale. But like, this is such a good fucking game. And I really wish I had the time to give this game what it deserves, because it absolutely deserves hours and hours and hours of my undivided attention.
Yeah, I am really glad you enjoyed it. That sounds very good. I've now wishlisted it on Steam, as well as I have for a few different games that we've talked about pretty recently. It seems like you've had a nice string of it, and I'm glad that you enjoyed it as much as you did, and I look forward to seeing if you go back to it. Right, obviously, now that you've talked about it on the podcast, anything you play is because you enjoyed it. So I hope you do get the chance to go and beat it.
Yeah, the bummer is I'm now gonna have to go play other things for the podcast. Mm. Which is like, again, we've had this conversation about like, oh, there's the game, you know, the game you're playing, the game you always have going on in the background that you're playing, and like, that's really all you can fit in life, right? With mm-hmm. with work and all the other responsibilities people have, right? So it's like, okay, how do I have this just be the game that's going on in the background when I have other games that I know are going to take me like 60 plus hours to beat that I'm going to need to have going on in the background for a while so I can play games for the podcast to talk about? Which, speaking of games for the podcast, I already know what game I'm playing for the next episode of the podcast. And I can't wait to tell you what it is in 2 weeks. I think you are going to be shocked and very, very happy that I gave this game a try. But that's a little tease for you. Chase, what have you been playing this week?
So, this is going to sound like a tangent, and it is, but I want you to stick with me on this journey.
All right.
So as you know, I have the K-pop Shenanigans podcast, yes. Right? We haven't done things in a while, but I do love me some K-pop. I even had you participate on a quiz show sometime that you can find on our YouTube channel, in which you had to try to guess what the names of K-pop groups meant, right?
Okay. Oh,
and the last couple years, I have found that the number one song of the year was in the top two of my end of year list. Like, the one that got all the awards, that got all the critical attention and the fan play and the whatever else, like, I had the most normie take possible.
We get it. You live in LA, you're plugged into the cultural zeitgeist. I get it.
I don't think the K-pop cultural zeitgeist is based in LA, but regardless, I feel like Korea might have some thoughts about that. But like, it's just this idea of like, you know, sometimes the basic is good. Sometimes the thing that everyone likes, they like for a reason, right? Maybe pumpkin spice lattes are popular because pumpkin spice is just a nice fucking flavor, right?
It's not.
I'm not gonna bite that bullet because I don't feel like getting lost in that tangent. I will have to disagree, but that's fine. But all of this is to say that I'm playing the roguelike, the card game roguelike that everyone and their mom is playing right now. And it's because every one of them is right and this game's fucking fantastic. And it's called Balatro. And you probably already knew that I was playing it if you followed any game that I have ever played for this podcast. There was like, I am at a point right now. I don't have a lot of financial flexibility. Buying a new game feels very silly, but sometimes something is so fucking good and so fun and catches the zeitgeist in such an obvious way that it gets my $15. And it turns out they're all right. Everyone's right. This game's awesome. So what do you know about Balatro? Because I've seen this everywhere in my feed, but I don't know if our YouTube... I know our YouTube views align somewhere, but not everywhere. So what do you know before I get into it?
Well, I know if either of us say zeitgeist again, I'm pretty sure we're going to show up on NPR. So maybe let's not use that word anymore. If I could be very blunt and very honest, I have mm-hmm. seen the word Balatro. I have seen mm-hmm. YouTube thumbnails of some YouTubers like Small Ant, who I've been watching a lot recently. And Hayden, who I believe is the, like, mainly does Hayden stuff. I think that's how you say his name, Hayden or Hayden. I have seen them reference this game. I know fucking nothing about it because I have not gotten dragged into the God damn it. I have not gotten dragged into the hullabaloo about it.
Has Small Ant played Balatro? I don't think he has.
I think he just, like, recently played it. I'll go double check his YouTube, but...
It's definitely not on his YouTube, because I follow Small Ant regularly, and that is not a game he has played, which I only bring up because I want to make sure that we're talking about the same game, my friend.
Maybe it was somebody else, and maybe I just thought it was Small Ant.
The moral of the story is, it sounds like you don't have a huge grasp, so I get to start at the basics, which is great. Balatro is poker, but a roguelike. Do you like poker, Walter? Do you enjoy some good five-card stud? Good Texas Hold'em?
I'm a Texas Hold'em guy. I do enjoy Texas Hold'em. A bit of a 21 lad when I was in Vegas. But sure. Hold'em would be my preferred method of playing poker.
Poker's great, right? But the problem with poker is that it's played for money. And if you have money, then you lose a lot of money playing poker against people who are better at it than you are. And if you don't have money, then you can play poker with like pieces of candy or whatever, but it doesn't have the same stakes, right? Poker inherently benefits from the pressure being on, from the decisions you make having real tangible consequences. And you have to decide, what am I willing to sacrifice? What am I willing to get rid of to try to build the best hand possible, right? So, this game gives you a target of points that you need to hit, referred to in this case as chips, right? And every hand type has a basic value of chips that you get for it, and a basic multiplier that it will use in this formula that it calculates. And depending on the cards you use, you can add more to that, right? For example, aces are worth 11, all your face cards and tens are worth 10. Your three is worth 3 chips, right? So higher cards are better from a pure point scoring perspective, at least early on. We'll get to that. So you start your very first hand and you're just trying to make the best poker hand you can. You've got, let's say, somewhere between 3 and 4 hands that you can play, depending on what deck that you brought, and somewhere between 3 and 4 discards that you can use. And discards allow you to take up to 5 cards from this hand of 8 that you start with and just throw them away. But it's a standard deck when you're first starting out. It's just a straight-up deck of cards. And you make the best hands that you can. And with 3 discards, right, you could probably make a pretty good hand of poker, right? If I gave you 8 cards and I said you could discard up to 5 of them up to 3 times, you could probably guarantee yourself a flush, right? You could guarantee yourself a full house or a straight or some type of score that would be pretty good in an average game of poker, right? That tracks mathematically to you, right?
Yeah, no, that would make sense.
But here's the thing. The amount of points you need to score increases every round, and increases sometimes exponentially, especially as you get into endless mode. So how are you going to get more points? Well, jokers are wild, Walter, as you know very well. And you can buy jokers at the shop that will allow you to adapt based on what jokers you buy. So, for example, there's the Sly Joker that gives plus 50 chips to any hand that you play as long as it contains at least one pair, right? Or maybe you have the Lusty Joker, which gives you a plus 4 multiplier every time that you play a heart card that scores. And it has to be something that scores. You can't just throw it in there. Like, if you have a hand that is two pair, right? Whatever that fifth card is that isn't adapting anything to you, that isn't actually part of what's being scored, you don't get any credit for that. So throwing in your best card doesn't do anything for you. And for the record, you don't need to play a five-card hand every time. You can play four cards. You can play two cards. You can play a whole one card if that's what you need in this specific situation. But you have these ways of building multipliers and adding chips to what you do. And these jokers that you get shift the way that you play, right? If you have the Lusty Joker, it sure would be good if you could get more hearts in your deck, right? Since hearts give you that multiplier, you want to play as many hearts as you can. And in a standard deck of cards, that's only 25% of your deck. That's not going to get you very far, is it? So, we've got tarot cards. And tarot cards are consumables that you can use to change cards in some way, shape, or form. You can get the Lovers, which turns a card into a wild card. It counts as any suit that you want and will score accordingly. You can get a Glass card, and by turning a card into glass, you give it a times 2 multiplier, but there's a 25% chance that it destroys itself once it's played. You can get a multiplier card. Just take two cards to give 4 multiplier whenever you play them. But most importantly, you have cards like the Star and the Moon that can take 3 of your selected cards and turn them into the suit of that tarot card's choice. Are you starting to see where the roguelike elements come in here?
Oh, I'm definitely starting to see it. I am definitely starting to see it, and I am wondering what college degree do I need to be able to comprehend this game?
You know, it's a game that makes you want to learn the math. I'll put it that way. I mean, really, the only thing you need to know is that addition is not as strong as multiplication, because the order in which your jokers appear at the top will affect the score that you get, right? If you have a joker that, for example, I'll use one of my favorite jokers. One of my favorite jokers that I use regularly is the Fibonacci Joker. And the Fibonacci Joker says that each ace, 2, 3, 5, or 8, i.e. the cards in a playing deck of cards that are in part of the Fibonacci sequence, gives a +8 multiplier when it's scored, right? +8's a lot of points, and you can do that multiple times. If you have a pair of twos, that's +16 right there. But it's a lot stronger when you have it alongside something like, say, ice cream, right? Ice cream gives you 100 chips for every hand played. Now, it takes 5 chips away from its total benefit each time you play it, so the ice cream does melt eventually, but that certainly helps you out quite a bit. But maybe you get the, what's the name of it? I think of it in my head as the Celestial Joker, though I know that's not the name of it. I'm going through my, here it is, the Constellation Joker. And that gives you a 0.1 multiplier per planet card that you've used so far. So if you play a bunch of planet cards, this thing creates a massive multiplier that is now used. And if you have it at the end, it multiplies the total multiplier that you've built by whatever that factor is. And so if you've added up a bunch of multipliers before that, that additional multiplication turns out to be very, very good. Or maybe you have something like Yorick, who says that he'll give you a times 5 multiplier to every hand you play, but you have to do 23 different discards first. So you buy it early, and you just discard as much as you can, even if you don't need to, so that you can get Yorick, and suddenly everything you have gets an additional times 5 multiplier at the end, which is fucking insane. And I know what you're thinking, Walter. Wait, you can't just blow over the constellation. There are planets involved in this? Of course there are planets involved in this, because you're not just leveling up your deck and adjusting it in its own way. You also have to adjust the scoring system, right? So these planets allow you to level up different types of hands, right? You can get the Earth planet card that gives you +2 multiplier and an extra 25 chips anytime you play a full house. Or Jupiter, which gives you +2 multiplier and +15 chips anytime you use a flush. So if you start building your deck so that you're getting the same type of hand over and over, you can buy those planet cards specifically, and suddenly you're doing a lot better at the one thing your deck is designed to do. And I know what you're thinking, Walter. I mean, sure, those tarot cards sound like some good ways to change things, but that can only take you so far, right? Well, that's where enhancements come in, because you have the ability to get cards that have their own special abilities, like the wild card I mentioned earlier, but also the steel card that says if you're not playing it during that turn, it gives a 1.5 times multiplier to whatever is being played, or the gold card, which gives you $3 at the end of each round, which is good because you need to use that to get more jokers or more cards added to your deck, because you can buy more standard cards to add to your deck. And sometimes those standard cards have enhancements already, or they have seals. Like, let's say I go to the shop, I buy a card pack, and I see there's the 4 of clubs, and it has the red seal, and it's a glass card, which means that it gives a 2x multiplier when it's used, and the red seal says that you get to re-trigger it, which means you get another 2x multiplier. And let's say you have that joker that gives you a multiplier every time you play a club, so now you're adding that and multiplying it again each time that it triggers, and you can start to see how things get very silly very quickly.
I, you keep asking me, I know what you're thinking, and the reality is I am Googling FBI databases for Canadians that were arrested in like Atlantic City and Las Vegas for counting cards, because this seems like somebody that was really good at poker and counting cards and made a whole bunch of money playing poker, but then got caught doing it and decided they wanted to make poker even more fucking complicated.
Well, it's not complicated per se, because everything is based on poker rules, right? The cards in your hand are the same cards that you're used to drawing in a deck. The key is that you're able to customize your deck. You're able to upgrade your deck. You're able to upgrade the types of hands that give you greater benefits. And because you can make these changes through seals, through enhanced cards, and tarot cards and planet cards and spectral cards. I'm not even going to get into the spectral cards, but those also have some incredible powerful effect, usually at some sort of drawback, similar to what you'd see in like a Slay the Spire run with your mana stuff, right? But the idea, right, is that you build a deck that is yours. Each enhancement is built one step of at a time. You're not swarmed with all this information at once, and there are always tooltips explaining exactly what it is that you're going to do. The game encourages you to explore, to figure out what works, to try different things. And as you get better at the game and you start realizing what types of jokers do very well for you, you can start modifying those jokers. Like if you get a holographic joker, then it adds an extra 10 multiplier compared to what it was, or a polychrome joker that gives an extra multiplication the thing, or a negative joker, which gets you more joker slots so you can play more jokers. And because this game hasn't gone far enough in allowing you to customize and personalize your deck, you also, as you could probably work backwards from, right? If you can modify cards and you can add cards, then you can make a type of hand that isn't playable in a traditional poker game, right? For example, a five of a kind. That's a legal hand in this game. If you add enough of a certain type of card, you can very easily end up with a five of a kind. Or a flush house, right? A full house that also is all the same suit. Or a flush five, which is the five of a kind, but they're also the same suit. And that sounds incredibly difficult to do. And it is. Those are particularly hard planets to achieve. But when you pull it off, because you've built your deck smartly, because you've gotten the right upgrades, or maybe even you just picked the right starting deck in the first place, it feels really damn good. And the game gives you a lot of different options on where to start to allow that for that experience, right? For example, you can get the Nebula deck if you win with, I believe it's the blue deck that starts with. And blue deck, the starting decks are all very simple, right? It's just like, hey, you get an extra hand that you can play, or an extra discard, or here's 10 extra dollars to start your run. But when you do well with those, it gives you more complicated stuff because you understand the game now. So you can get a telescope voucher, which means that the celestial packs that you get always contain the planet card for the hand that you're playing most. So you're guaranteed to get the thing that you're looking for every time that you get one of those. Or you can get a checkered deck that is all spades and hearts. And it sure seems like if you only have two suits rather than four, you're going to get a lot of flushes very quickly. And it makes stuff like a flush house a lot more achievable than it seemed the first time that, you know, you thought about it. And it's that depth that is why everyone is so hooked on this game, and why it's so easy to get into, right? You don't need to understand all of the math. You need to know that upgrading a thing makes it stronger, that adding is less powerful than multiplying, and that upgrading cards makes them better than if they're not upgraded in 99.9% of cases. But the more you play from this basic poker understanding that we basically all have, right? If you care about card games at all, someone has brought out a deck of cards and taught you the basics of poker. There is so much depth and so much intrigue and so many ways to play. And the game challenges you every step of the way. There are blinds that you have to succeed at, and these blinds get harder and harder each time. You might have something like the needle, which says that you can only play one hand, so you better make that one hand count. Or you can have the tooth, which costs you money for every card you play, which, if you don't have a lot of money or you need that money to buy something important, that's going to be a problem. You can have cards handed face down to you, and you have to decide whether you want to try to use them or throw them away in favor of getting something that you actually know what the hell it is. It's always an interesting challenge, right? What do you do if none of your spade cards work anymore? Well, you better have a strategy that isn't about spades. What do you do if the game says you can't use any cards that you already used previously in this run? Well, I hope that you have thought of a way to come up with different styles of hands, right? To mix up your strategy from bit to bit, because that one way you were playing can't carry you if the game says you get no points for using those cards anymore. And all of those challenges are fun. They're all interesting. They're always a new thing that you have to overcome. And I understand the trepidation because I threw out a lot of individual metrics at you, but they are all individual metrics, right? They're not all thrown at you at once. You're not able to do all of these things immediately. you need to keep beating levels to get the money to bit by bit make this machine that turns your poker deck into thousands or millions of points. And I gotta tell you, there is nothing more satisfying than when you get the right jokers and the right upgrades and the right tarot cards, the right planets, whatever, to score so far above whatever is required of you from a single hand, because you've built something that is absolutely fucking broken. And the game says, way to go. Keep breaking things. Have a great time.
This sounds anxiety-inducing.
I mean, is Slay the Spire anxiety-reducing? Because Slay the Spire has a lot more complex mechanics than poker.
I mean, I guess. Like, I like, fair, but...
Like none of what I've described is different than, like, leveling up a card or getting a new relic that allows you to do things differently.
Yeah. No, I guess that's fair. Just in the moment, every time you said depth, it just was like a fucking dagger into my skull of anxiety. That's just like, I don't understand how this is fun. Because, like, I'll be blunt. I don't play Slay the Spire with strategy. I just brute force it. And I just am like, well, I think I remember that kind of being good or, like, that kind of being fun. And, like, I don't think this is a game for me. I don't think that's a play style that meshes well with me as a person. Like I said, like, this just sounds anxiety inducing to me.
I will say, I would never pressure anyone to play a game that they're not immediately interested in. There's so many good games out there. But I think it is a lot more approachable than any list of game mechanics could ever be, right? I get into all of these different details because the number of ways that you can customize things is fun and satisfying. But you don't need to be perfect to have a great time, right? I sent you a picture here. It's the header of the polygon image. And you can see here just, like, this is all understandable, right? Like, there are cards that are being played. Some of them look a little bit different from a color perspective. And it's weird that it says that this is a straight, despite the fact that there's no 10 in this Jack 9-8-7-6 hand. But all of these things are individual elements gained one step at a time that allowed you to do some cool shit. And that's what a roguelike is at the end of the day, right? It is a vehicle through which, through a variety of different upgrade paths and different opportunities that are made available to us, we create something that is both deeply familiar to our starting place and also feels like it was worlds away. And to accomplish that with poker is an incredible accomplishment, because they took a game that feels solved, that feels standard, that feels like the thing that everybody plays, and they found a way to make it nuanced and interesting and endlessly replayable. And so I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to shut you like I'm going to be like everybody else on the internet and tell you to go play it, because there's nothing like this out there on the market. It is so tightly done, so endlessly replayable, and with combos that will have you feeling giddy. There are just sometimes you get the right things aligned and you are unstoppable, and it's a great time. And sometimes you get unlucky, because in poker you tap out, you know, sometimes you just don't get the hand you need. You don't draw the cards and, oh, well, time to start again. And it just captures that gameplay loop in such a powerful way, despite coming from such a quote unquote basic place. So shout out to the developers of Balatro, because I think that's quite the accomplishment.
This game gave me so much anxiety, I just went and bought a Call of Duty game to feel calm. Not really, but like, I understand where you're coming from, and I don't want to do this as a like harsh your mellow type thing, because you're right, like out game mechanics, like of course it's gonna sound fucking anxiety inducing, and if I went through every single game mechanic that was in fucking Civilization, you'd probably be like, I'd never fucking play that game ever. It's why people like you, Chase, love reading the directions for board games and then summarizing them for your friends.
Yeah for sure. But this is
the meme of like, oh, I'm finally ready to get out of my box. And the thing like leaves its box, gets the shit beat out of it, and then like goes back into its box. And that's like me right now being like, I don't want to leave the box. I'd rather just play Madden. I'm okay. I'll just play Madden.
Well, that's fair. It is certainly, you know, this is for card game roguelike people and card game roguelike people exclusively. And if you're one of those people, honestly, you probably didn't need me talking about this game. You're probably already playing it. There's a reason that it was profitable within an hour of being released and made over $1 million despite being a small indie game within six. Like, this game is everywhere. If you follow someone who likes roguelikes, you know, even like a Super Auto Pets of the world, right? You've seen this. But I'm just here to tell you it's great. The thing you've seen that looks so fun, it's just that it is that fun. It's worth your time. But hopefully you feel like this podcast was worth your time. If you do, you should definitely follow us on the Spotify's or Anchor or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you should check out Final Cut, that movie podcast we do every Monday. We're not doing this. Walter, where can the nice people at home find you?
Listen, you guys can find me at C80s_LOL on Twitter or at C80s.bsky.social. Pumpkin Spice is trash.
You got death on the brain. I get it. That's fair.
Pumpkin Spice is trash, man. It's fucking disgusting. I think all of you guys need a fucking lobotomy that like Pumpkin Spice. I know that's rude, but also that shit's disgusting. As always, you can also follow the podcast at Rough Drafts Podcast on Twitter it's at Rough Drafts Pod on Twitter at Rough Drafts Podcast.bsky.social.
Absolutely. You can find me, Chase Wassener, at bsky.social. Let us know what you think about any of the games we've talked about today or other days. You know, we always love hearing your thoughts and feelings on these things. So be sure to keep us in the loop. Be sure to check out twitch.tv/redshirtking. You know, I've been doing some streams every now and then. There was a very fun stream that I did with a friend, Sneko, going through The Movies, which is a game I'll talk about some point once I've gotten a little bit deeper into it. But hope to see you over there. Love interacting with chat. But for now, I guess until next time, goodbye, Internet.